coming to you live from inside the globe, perched high atop the Bugle Planet building in sunny Gotham City. It's Hey Kids Comics with two guys who are always ready to seduce the innocent, your hosts, Andrew Farmer and the Jedi Cole Houston. And now it's time for Hey Kids Comics.
It's open mic night here.
Oh my god. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Hey Kids Comics. I am your co-host Andrew Farmer. With me as always, my co-host and life partner, producer and vocalizer.
I'm getting self-conscious about it. We're like hundreds of miles apart over Skype, and I'm getting self-conscious all of a sudden, like, oh, now they're watching me.
I was going to call you the Michael Winslow of the Jedi Cole universe. The Jedi Cole. Oh, is that a helicopter? Should just do the whole thing as Michael Winslow. That brilliant Key and Peele sketch, the Michael Winslow fights, Bobby McFerrin.
Oh, yes.
Because it's so good. But tonight we talk about another type of show. I'm very excited about this issue of Hey Kids Comics. This is issue 197, There you go. We'll just call it that. This is something that I've been wanting to do for a while. I am a huge documentary fan. And if you ever listen to this show, you know that Cole is as well, especially if Ken Burns is involved.
Oh, indeed.
The ill-fated...
It was very often that Ken would drop by, and I would point out, you're presently doing a documentary on the baseball, and I'm a Civil War author. I appreciated his attention, but it got a little stalky.
A lot of people don't know this, and if we ever get the Patreon page up, I think I'm going to go balls deep into making this work out. That Cole and I have a documentary that we made. It just needs to be finished and put together. It was untenable to do it. We were going to do it for an AllCon, and it became untenable to do it prior to we didn't have enough time. It was too truncated. We didn't have enough time to fully put it together, but I still have all the pieces for it. We were going to do a documentary on Marvel Civil War in the style of Ken Burns Civil War.
That's right.
And we recorded a bunch of weird stuff for it, if you remember right. Like, we did a whole bunch of, like weird overdub recordings, and we had the Civil War music that we put together. And we also had the document. Didn't we have the documentary on Scourge as well, weren't we?
Oh, yeah, we did. We actually did produce the – it was just like a little tribute piece. That Andy helped me put together quite brilliantly, very much in the vein of the little the Academy Awards, the very sanguine who we lost this year, and which its sole purpose nowadays is to spark fierce debate in social media about who they forgot to mention that we lost this year. I don't think we left anybody out, but we did those that we lost to the Scourge of the Underworld. Back in, what, 80s?
Yeah, so on, during his reign of terror.
Yes, and we actually paid a long overdue tribute to Basilisk, Birdman, the Animan, Hammer and Anvil, characters too long forgotten.
Right. It was so much fun. It was one of my highlights of ever doing one of the weird things that Cole and I put together and then just run with. Like, that was... It's between that, the remotes that we had for USG from Harry Potter World.
Yes, the Butterbeer Riot was one of the best.
So good.
I think I can scare that up. That was the first and only time the USG, the world, or the, what was it?
The mobile.
Oh, yeah, the mobile crisis unit. And I actually, in my garage to this day, have a Winnebago, a little, like, Tonka Winnebago. that was going to become the miniature of the Mobile Crisis Unit with all kinds of antennas and stuff. And one of these days, I need to mock that sucker.
You do, you do. And we also and we also did the radio play that we did for back with Eddie and Colleen. JCU goes camping and gets taken by something in the woods issue, the lost episode, which still to this day is my favorite thing like I've ever produced personally for this show. But I digress. We are obsessed with documentaries.
We are indeed, so much so that we'll talk about anything else remotely resembles them.
But one thing I had been sadly remiss on. I have watched documentaries on serial killers, sushi, video games. I had never once watched a documentary on comic books.
I am ashamed.
I am ashamed of myself. So that's when this popped into my head that I've done myself a disservice and we should really do an issue of Hey Kids Comics on
now,
comic books.
I can't say that I've seen just a preponderance of them, but it is it's fascinating to me that there are documentaries on comic books.
Right.
And not solely on, you know, how Stan Lee rules the world or, you know, things that are every documentary has its own approach to its subject matter. And there's a great amount of overlap you're going to find if you take this to heart and start seeking them out. But it was amazing when we were doing the research for this show how many documentaries has cropped up that I wasn't aware of.
Right.
Even during the years at Diamond, when every now and again someone would produce a documentary and you'd try to sell it through previews.
Right.
Or it was either that or just some really ridiculous circle jerk of artists.
Yes.
Like Stan Lee and Rob Liefeld create overt kill.
Oh, God, that hurts. That hurts me. By the way, speaking of Stan Lee, did you see that he sold the movie rights to his story, to his life?
No, I did not.
He sold the movie rights, and they're saying it's going to be like a 70s action movie.
Oh, one would expect no less.
Which is just ridiculous. Hey, he's starting to really after the.
I think Jean-Claude Van Damme should play it.
Well, after 2 issues ago, after Eddie's story, it's really painted a different picture of Stan Lee for me. Also, one of the documentaries that I watched painted a little bit of a different story. I think we're starting to see, with all this influx of information, a different side to the man that maybe, while he isn't an awful guy, he definitely isn't the caricature of perfection that I think we've all been led to believe, which I know isn't a popular thing to say, but, you know, he is man, not God. And I think that that's interesting that we're starting to see that. And that's what these things do really well, these documentaries, is attack things and open doors that you might not have known existed. And there are so many that get brought up often. And what Cole and I did was pick a couple to watch and review.
Oh, yeah, especially Ken Burns' Stan Lee. It was a fast documentary.
Stan Lee's Carlton Comics.
Yeah, a lot of dispatches and stuff.
Yeah, from the field. It's just...
Yeah.
The voices didn't work as well, though. You know, like
yeah.
Well, he insisted. He insisted on being himself. That's the problem.
Yeah, that really was. It was Stan Lee as Stan... And most of the other voices. It was like the... It was like that Watchmen motion comic.
Right.
Because it was all voiced by Stan Lee.
Well,
my dearest Stan. Is that supposed to be his wife? I don't understand. I feel like I'm watching Polar Express. All the characters sound the same.
So I opened this question on Reddit today to the comic book subreddit, just asking if anybody had seen any or have any to for us to talk about. I will over and over again, and I think this is a good place to start, because 3 different times they said Comic Book Confidential is good, which I've heard it's very good. I plan on watching it. American Splendor, of course, is one of those where it's not as much a documentary as it is a full feature, but still I've heard it's very good.
Something of a dramatization of, and that's the other thing with, you know, you have your documentaries and you have a handful of things that step outside the documentary format.
Right.
Where that was more, who am I thinking of here? We've played him from Lady in the Water, played Harvey Pekar. I'm sorry. That's the only thing that came to mind.
Paul Giamatti is the name.
Paul Giamatti.
Lady, wait, wait, wait. Lady in the Water?
That one.
Can we go? Can I back? I want to take a step back and say that your reference point for Paul Giamatti is Lady in the Water. Paul Giamatti movies
until just now.
In all the world, Lady in the Water. But yes, no, you're absolutely right. His portrayal. But
in all fairness, that is the most pure, unadulterated. This is like, Walter White blue meth of Jedi cult reference points.
It really is. That is the patient zero. That is the outbreak monkey.
I think listeners would be disappointed if I had gone with Sideways or any number of other.
Sure. What movie? I just saw him in a movie that he was very good in, and now I can't. The Lady in the Water reference just wiped it clean out of my memory. Yeah. I got nothing.
I could have mentioned Cinderella Man. I could have mentioned any number of other.
You could have, but you went straight to Lady in the Water, and I love you for that. You're fearless. You're fearless. So brave. You're right.
But again, the conversation becomes derailed, as is often the case when anyone invokes Lady in the Water.
But yeah, and the other one that was referenced pretty heavily was the This Will Make Eddie Happy, and I would like to have, at some point we'll talk about this, the recent release of the Turtle Power Definitive History of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. But the one that comes up, back to Paul Giamatti, the one that came up over and over again was one that you watched. You watched Crumb, didn't you?
I actually saw Crumb in its theatrical release.
Okay.
And it's a fascinating, I would recommend Crumb, even if it wasn't a very well-made documentary. It is a very well-made documentary. But any documentary about Robert Crumb would be a must-see because it's Robert freaking Crumb. One of the – is pretty much the seminal the figurehead of Underground Comics, that C-O-M-M-I-X.
Right.
He is the underground cartoonist extraordinaire because he is a very good artist who does some bizarre-ass stuff. It is not for the weak of heart or mind because Robert Crumb's work is not for the – if you're unfamiliar, Keep on Truckin'.
Right, right.
Is actually referenced. Of course, you can't talk to Robert Crumb and not mention that. And I don't want to say much there, but it's worth the price of admission just to see to see the man himself express his feelings about that particular cultural icon, otherwise known for Mr. Natural, Fritz the Cat.
Fritz the Cat, yeah.
In fact, I remember reading long before seeing the movie I knew that Fritz the Cat was a complete disappointment to Crumb. He felt that, the volumes of work that he'd written on the character, his hyper weed sex culture anthropomorphic grandfather of Omaha the Cat Dancer, much less sophisticated in that kind of like dirty uncle way that you have to admit is your relation, but you don't want to.
Right.
He was very disappointed. I knew also that he immediately upon the release of the Bakshi film, he had Fritz the Cat impaled on an ice pick by a jealous lover. Pretty much murdered the character, knowing full well that he wouldn't have that sort of Arthur Conan Doyle writing campaign to revive a dead character because all of his readership were too stoned to notice.
Now,
that's not from the documentary. That's a personal observation.
So when you watch the film, right, the Paul Giamatti film, did you get that sense?
No, you're maybe confusing. Paul Giamatti's film was American Splendor was based on the life and times of Harvey Pekar.
You're right.
Creator of the comic.
But you saw Crumb when it came out. I'm sorry. You're right.
I didn't see Crumb. Crumb is a more direct, targeted type of documentary where they actually go and meet their subject matter.
Oh, okay.
And you get some really amazing kind of precursor. He's showing off his volumes and volumes of sketchbooks that he created over the years. He would just go out and draw people and things the way genuine artists tell genuine artist they ought to be conducting themselves. They just go out into the world and draw everything, because the best artists, especially in sequential graphic art like comics and comic strips, are those who can draw anything under the sun.
Right.
And he literally is honing his craft and then taking that skill and developing this weird style that is just because he has a very twisted imagination. But you're actually getting to have an intimate portrait of the artist and his work. But he's showing off these sketchbooks. He's talking about how he traded a guy all of his like beaten up old attaché case full of his sketchbooks from over the years for a house in France.
Wow.
And he and his wife were going to move off and live the rest of their life in France, and presumably that's what panned out for him.
That's pretty amazing. Like, what was the most shocking revelation for you watching that? Because that's the thing, right, about these documentaries, is that you have an idea of in your head, right, of the man or the mystery or the myth, and then there's some revelation that's thrown at you that you absolutely didn't see, left field, you never saw coming. So, like, was there something in this that just stands out to you as, like, the thing that you never imagined was going to be?
Well, I mean, I had a passing familiarity with Robert Crumb.
Sure, of
course. Most commonly known as R. Crumb, as he would always sign his work. And I knew that he liked big butts before thing. I knew about Fritz the Cat, Mr. Natural, a lot of those other things. I had a vague awareness of the underground comics movement. And so from what I knew, from what I'd seen of his work and knew in passing about his life, I knew he was a pretty fucked up kind of guy.
Right, sure.
So perhaps the biggest revelation is that his brother is even more fucked up than he is. Because one of the things I want to talk about on this issue is that documentarians, except those who, in a Ken Burns way, speak to the past. When you speak to the past, it's a lot harder to get distracted,
right,
than when you're speaking to the moment, to the present. And the thing that I've noticed in most documentaries, and a great many documentaries, unless they're just focused with a laser sharp precision or settle upon a handful of individuals and just adhere to nothing else but the activities of those individuals, documentarians trying to paint with a broad brush tend to paint with a broad brush that goes off the canvas.
Right.
I can cite one of my favorite documentaries of all times, Trekkies. Both Trekkies and Trekkies 2 suffer from being derailed by the filmmaker's desire to sit down and give airtime to someone who has nothing to do with the subject matter at hand.
Right.
Remotely. Like this loony old fruit bat who's obsessed with UFOs.
I remember that.
And don't get me started about the dead astronaut's wife guy. Those of you who are in the know are really going to enjoy a chuckle at that. Crumb suffers from this in that you go from gazing into the abyss as a documentarian choosing your subject matter as Robert Crumb to discovering that the abyss is adjacent to a more abyssal abyss.
The abyss is the waiting room.
Yes. You didn't realize there were more depths to the deepest, darkest sinkhole of the human spirit until you meet Robert Crumb's brother. And so it's little wonder they got distracted from him for a while, and you learn about his bizarre practices that he supposedly picked up from Near Eastern fakirs and such. But the strangest thing is to see his artwork.
His brother's artwork?
His brother's artwork, okay. Because it will etch itself into your soul. And the other revelation is Robert Crumb's childhood fascination. And I'm going to leave it at fascination because I want people to seek this movie out and find out exactly the level to which fascination can be taken with Bugs Bunny.
Really?
With Bugs Bunny as beyond just a entertainment value.
All right.
To the point of a kind of obsession that borders on the dangerous.
Like what's in the box?
Not as funny as, you know, blowing up Yosemite Sam with a cannon kind of dangerous, but Bugs Bunny is just there, and because as you hear him speak of this, you get this sort of strange Helsinki syndrome, because you start to actually, at least in my case, you start to empathize, and you begin to see, like, wow, I guess he kind of does. No, I do not want to think that one. Not remotely. That's a travesty as well.
I don't feel empathy for this.
Yeah, you know. So that I think are the twin revelations of that. But it's fascinating. Again, like I say, it gets a little off its tracks when it starts to follow the Robert Crumb brother thing. But what was neat is some years after seeing that, maybe in less, it may have been within a year or so of seeing Crumb. I believe it was Fantagraphics. Fantagraphics Books began publishing the sketchbooks.
Really?
Volumes that would encompass like a couple of year period or something like that.
Wow.
By way of example, volume 4, late 1966, at which point Cole was turning 1, to mid 67.
So a lot of just
there is a lot of material there. Lots of fanciful cartoon women with enormous, you know, taking gluteus maximus to the max. But it's fascinating stuff because that's a glimpse into an artist that you don't normally get, especially a living artist.
Right.
And you know, you get to see some of the what drives the man.
Right.
And some very unique looks at things. And at one point, apparently, some friends decided to treat him to a photo shoot with the kind of, I guess you would call them, you know, the term Rubenesque, of course, refers to the types of models, the types of women that Rubens were commonly featured in his art.
Right.
There's certain other terms that escape me at the moment that are also sort of connected to the type of imagery. I would have to say the crumb build women.
Yes, yes.
They've specifically found women with, you know, bodies that were decidedly down heavy, like the women he draws. You have very thick legs, very large asses, and the rest of them sort of tapering upward.
Right, right.
And you discover that it isn't just an R. Crumb exaggeration. People can actually and do actually look like that. And but you know, he's just, the man is in heaven because he's surrounded by all these nude and semi-nude women who are exactly the sort of things he'd been drawing all these years, apart from the nipples that could put your eye out from space.
Sure, sure, yeah. He definitely had what one would refer to as an exaggerated style until you realize that it wasn't that far of an exaggeration.
Yeah. But he has a wonderful sense of the human body in motion that really, I think, sets him apart as an artist within his own genre. You know, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, you look at some Picassos and people sort of mentally piss on them, say, oh, I got to do better than that. But if you look at some of Picasso's work that isn't the defining style, he was actually a very good, realistic artist.
Right. Oh, man. Well, that's awesome. So would you suggest that people seek out Crumb and watch it?
I think just from the standpoint of looking at a piece of comic book history that would otherwise be ignored by and large. If you're unfamiliar with his work, it's a fascinating peek into a piece of Americana, if you will, because I think the underground comics movement is sort of the forgotten piece of this piece of Americana.
Right.
Because the comic book is a very American thing. And like the country itself, it is a diverse entity.
Yes.
And this is that sort of, it's almost like seeing a documentary about aspects of the country you don't think about because they're so far removed from your day-to-day life. And it's just, he's a fascinating character. I mean, but for the fact that you know he's real, you almost would think that he was a creation of some really astute writer who understood the human condition and then took it a step further.
So I'm going to ask you, which one do you want me to talk about first? Because you know the two that I watched, and I want you to.
I think that the Ditko
okay
documentary needs to be our crescendo.
Okay. Because well
that. There's a lot of ground to cover there on a very personal level as well.
So the first one that I watched, let me start with this. I set out with the best intentions to watch Grant Morrison talking with gods, but the problem with that is it's much like you would imagine it would be. It's impossible to find. You can buy copies of it on Amazon for $80. You have to get an Apache shaman to come to your house with ayahuasca and take it. It's a whole thing. But I'm going to watch it. I'm hoping that I get to watch it and rein it in for the future Chaos Magic Grant Morrison Creator Spotlight when we come to that about a year from now, a little plus probably
or longer. Yeah, yeah, it's hard to say. But we just keep adding and adding and adding.
The thing I love about documentaries is I never watch a documentary on something that I know about. Something I'm familiar with, yes, but something that I really know about, I don't. Like I won't watch a documentary on penguins, and I won't watch a documentary on muscle cars. Like I want there to be some mystery there. So the two that I sook out for this endeavor were ones that ones with a mythology built around them. And the first one that I knew immediately I was going to watch was Death of Superman Lives, What Happens. It's a documentary around...
So it's hard to tell which one should be the crescendo at that point.
This one is fantastic. It's not necessarily about comics, but it does cross over. We've all heard Kevin Smith tell his story about writing the script for... and if you haven't, you should find it. It's all over the place. He actually says in the movie, he's like, I found my calling. My calling isn't writing scripts for movies. My calling is talking about writing scripts for movies. he's told the story over and over again, but it's the story of the ill-fated Tim Burton Superman movie and what it was to be, what it turned out to be. And it's very, very interesting. And I found this documentary to be heartwarming and kind of heartbreaking in the same respect. It was really cool. And the really cool part was watching it build. So they start with the idea and the script writing process. The guy who does it, John Schnepp, is the guy who puts it together, obviously has a passion for what happened here. Like, he's seen the stills that were on the internet of Nick Cage in the Superman suit. He's heard the stories
the
from Kevin.
Electric plastic.
I know why now. But I know why now, and that's the really cool part. Like, this tells you everything. I will say this. If they were to have made this movie, I'm not going to say it would have been a great Superman movie, but I think it would have been a pretty damn cool movie. The real story here is how it fell apart. I'm not going to spoil a whole lot of it, okay? But they had Warner Brothers, the absolute best Warner Brothers talent behind this thing. Tim Burton had all these brilliant original sketches. They had three versions of the script. Some of the ideas that they've had, and this is the really cool part, and this is the part that was my revelation, is that you start getting into them telling about what's going to happen. And what's going to happen is that Brainiac is going to be in it. We get the idea that Krypton is not just this like kind of utopian society, but it's this bio-organic, biomechanical society where, you know, it's almost Giger-esque. And they start talking about this type of thing. And then they start talking about Brainiac's going to be in it. And Brainiac is going to be shrouded. And then, you know, the later reveal is that he's just kind of the Brainiac head on a metal spider body, which the sketches looked really badass. But then you get into stuff like Brainiac's skull ship. Like, Brainiac has a menagerie of creatures that he's collected over time.
Wow.
and they have the sketches for it, and things like using Superman as the what we talk about on the show all the time, which is it's not Clark Kent and his alter ego Superman, it's Superman and his alter ego Clark Kent. And that makes...
So they were getting it right from that respect. And it also sounds like almost a combination of two documentaries I saw about films that never were, being Lost in La Mancha.
Yes, yeah, it was very similar.
And Jodorowsky's Dune.
No,
watch those movies and you're like, I want these films.
But they say that in the movie. Somebody says it. This would have been Jodorowsky's Superman. Like, this would have been that version of Superman. You're watching it, and so the story of, I could tell you everything about this movie and not spoil it, but the story of the electric blue suit. So Superman dies. That's the whole thing, right? The death of Superman. Superman Lives is the name. This is the Superman death and rebirth story. And due to the bioorganic nature, which later we see in the later, and that's the cool thing, is all of these ideas have shown up since. to the point where they had cast Kevin Spacey as Lex Luthor for this movie.
Yeah.
And he was in the Brandon Routh Superman Returns as Lex Luthor. Like, all of these really cool things, but the electric blue suit was a tiered, and they go through this with all these special effects companies, where the idea was, we need a regeneration suit. So a suit that Superman is going to be wearing while he's regenerating, while he's being reborn. So All of these different production houses, all these different like ILM type companies were coming forward with all these extravagant, crazy $1 million pieces with the idea that what was going to happen is you were going to have Superman kind of in this bath, you know, like this Kryptonian in the Fortress of Solitude, Kryptonian regeneration chamber. And it was going to start with one layer, and then those layer, and the funny thing they said was, this picture that blew up the internet, 30 seconds of film time it would have had, because it was a building, like all of these layers of the suit were going to build up on each other to become this like biomechanical power suit that allowed him to regenerate and still have Superman like powers. Sort of like, what was the name of his robot sentry in this Fortress of Solitude?
Well, yeah, he did have, like, some old Kryptonian tech.
Right.
Like, giant robots. And then there was also, I believe in the storyline, the Crisis of the Crimson Kryptonite, which had nothing to do with Russia, but I always have to say it that way because I spelled it all with K's, but where he lost his powers to Red Kryptonite, and he was Professor Hamilton built a supersuit for him at one point. Because he was still trying to go out and do the Superman things with, you know, gloves and rope. And
right.
And they thought, okay, now that's not happening. We need to get you something a little – we need to one-up it. So they got him an actual exoskeletal suit for a while.
One of the really cool concepts that they were playing with was what – and they were discussing the what if Superman didn't know that he was an alien. Because he crash landed and he was raised and they kept referring to it as what if it was his condition. And it was almost one of those like where he was trying to figure out what was wrong with him in comparison to the rest of the world, because he's the only one. So he's completely isolated and alone. And until Brainiac shows up with Kryptonian tech and all this stuff, nobody, he didn't know what he was. So they're like, well, it's Tim Burton, of course. So let's explore the idea that Superman is an outsider. Let's explore the emotional, because that's the only way you can get people to buy into Superman, is where's the emotional attachment? Where's the angst? Where's the outsider nature? Which was really cool. There's a beeline to this story all the way through. So you get this whole story, right, about how they were going to make the movie. They had all this test footage of Nick Cage trying on things with Tim Burton, and both of them are very excited. You know, they know that they're making something that if they get to finish it would be very important. Maybe not the best Superman movie. Maybe not a Superman movie that comic book fans would love, but something important.
Well, it might not have been the Superman movie we need. It was a Superman movie we deserve.
Yes, damn it. But that's the no. But you're not off in that respect, because they kept referencing back to Batman. Like, this isn't the Batman movie that everybody wanted at the time. You know, nobody wanted Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson in a Batman movie.
Well, Michael Keaton.
Right. But Jack Nicholson was too old to be – you know, there was all this whole thing, and all of a sudden, it worked. So this film, before it got shit-canned, had a $300 million budget in 1997.
Good Lord.
Right. Because of the set pieces, because of the casting, because of the ILM computer stuff, like, it was insane. And the
I had no clue.
Yeah, I'm not going to spoil this in any way, but you learn that literally the day of principal photography is when the movie got canceled.
Could not.
So the day that they finally got to get it all worked out, they finally go and this is a story about the journey, not the destination. But they finally get to the destination, and Warner Brothers pulls the plug on it, which was, you know, heartbreaking. And you see the heartbreak, and that's the other thing, is the cool thing about this movie is another cool thing is that you don't see a movie about, you see Tim Burton, you see all the screenwriters, you see all the special effects guys, you don't see Nick Cage wouldn't be in it, but you see all of the ILM guys, the computer graphics guys, you see the producers, you see the costumers. None of them were like, none of them had mean, bad, angry things to say, you know.
Yeah,
it wasn't like watching the Golden Globus documentary where Elvira's like, fuck you. It wasn't like that.
Yeah,
it was they all were whimsical and kind of heartbroken about the fact that it didn't get made. It wasn't just business, and it wasn't anger that it didn't get finished. It was like, imagine what it would have been, how great it would have been just to get this out.
Yes. Absolutely. And I think that's wherein it sounds very much like the Dune documentary. I had the good fortune to actually see at the historic Texas Theater. But, you know, I've got to go see this, but when am I ever going to get a chance to see this on the big screen or ever? And there was not a lot of bitterness involved with the fact that it never happened, unlike Lost in La Mancha, where there was still, you know, a lot of venom being thrown about. But, you know, things like this also give you wonderful insight. We go and see the finished product, but it's like going to the bakery and getting a delicious donut.
Right.
When you go to the movie theater and you don't know what went into, you don't really think about the fact that somebody had to go and throw a bunch of flour and eggs and sugar and whatever else goes into a donut. Is that a stout in it? Or no, I'm thinking of hot dogs. but you know, you don't think about all of the mechanisms. And a donut's a poor example because it's a much more simpler mechanism. But you know, if you go and have a lovely Chateaubriand, there's a lot of work that goes into that damn piece of meat. So
right.
But you don't see what makes that all come together. And that's why I love movie documentaries about movies, because they really capture that side of the struggle that most of us don't think about. And oddly enough, this invokes a comic I may have recommended on the show before, is Paul Chadwick's Concrete Fragile Creature.
Right.
Speaking of Tim Burton, because the director character in that, it's about the character Concrete being hired to work as a part of a practical effect, as it were, on a movie. And it's what I know about the Hollywood filmmaking process is enough to inform me that Chadwick did his homework. And it's almost like, who did you go and hang out with? Because it felt like all of the trials and heartbreaks and changes of fiction that go into filmmaking.
But the B-line story is as interesting as the A-line story. And the B-line story is about John Peters. And John Peters was the producer of the movie. He had produced the Batman movies. He is the epitome, the textbook epitome of Hollywood producer. Like, just crazy. Like, all the stories that they would tell about John Peters. You know, where they all had stories like he would come into the writer's room and just grab somebody and put him in a headlock and just put him in like a jiu-jitsu move, like almost Bobby Blakey style. Like, he would just walk in and all of a sudden you're in a headlock. And he would bring kids in to look at the pictures, like the storyboards. He would he's the one that Kevin Smith was saying that he had all of the screenwriters come in and read the script to him. He would lay on a couch, stare at the ceiling, and then have screenwriters read a script to him. And then
it sounds like that American director from the Monty Python sketch.
It's exactly what it is.
You sound like a yes man. I don't like yes men.
Yeah, no, apparently he would have everybody read to him. He was known as the loudmouth. Like he would be sitting there like he'd be like, there's not enough, like there was a, I guess there was a famous polar bear sequence where you're reading the script to him, and Superman, to get away from the world, right, goes to the Fortress of Solitude. And he's they're reading him the pages about the Fortress of Solitude. He approaches the Fortress of Solitude, the giant key, puts the giant key in, you know, and John Peter stops him, and he's like, hey, wait, it's been a long time, there hasn't been a fight scene. Why isn't there a fight scene? He's like, well, with all due respect, it's the Fortress of Solitude. Like, yeah, well, we need a fight scene. What about polar bears? What if he fights polar bears? They're ferocious. What if it's Superman. Like, why... Why would Superman fight polar bears at the Fortress of Solitude? Like, this is ridiculous. But
ill-tempered polar bears?
But no, exactly. Like, and apparently there's one script treatment with an actual polar bear fight scene. There's another script treatment with statues of polar bears for some reason. But there's also a fight scene with ninjas that he wanted in because ninjas were super hot.
Oh yeah, ninjas were the thing.
Yeah, so you had to have a fight scene with Superman fighting ninjas, which makes no sense. But they came together and decided that Doomsday, the way that Doomsday was in the comic book, didn't make sense. It makes sense in a comic book, but it doesn't make sense in a movie.
It doesn't make sense in a polar bear movie. That's for damn
right?
sure.
But so what they wanted to do, and this sounds, and they had pictures of this. They had like animatics of it. They wanted to make Doomsday like basically a kaiju, like just a giant monster.
Okay, so they wanted like Pacific Rim Doomsday.
Yeah, because who could like in the comics that like because they aren't comics fans, right? Except for Nick Cage, he obviously is. And Nick Cage, the documentary shows him throwing weight around. Like, no, Superman doesn't look like this. He looks like this, you know. And that's cool to see, like an actual comic fan. But they're like, it doesn't make sense. Like, a guy roughly the same size as Superman can kill Superman, even though he's not Superman. Superman's supposed to be the most powerful. This won't make sense to an audience. We need some. So they developed this big-ass, like, kaiju monster that was Doomsday.
So it has to be, like, the fist the size of Superman himself.
Right.
Because only fists that size could possibly harm Superman himself.
To give you an example of where John Peter's head is at, and I'm almost done. I'm going to wrap this up. And I do suggest that everyone watch this. You can go – if you go to the website for – if you just search for the Death of Superman Lives, What Happened, it's about $7 to rent it. It's worth all $7. but they were talking about a scene where after Superman dies, they have the funeral. You know, and Kevin Smith says he wrote the entire movie just to write Batman into the funeral. Like, that was his entire reason for writing the movie. But
that was his intent.
John Peters calls one of the screenwriters up and says, turn on the TV right now, or something to the effect of, hey, turn on the TV right now. And Princess Dies had just died, and the funeral was on the news.
Oh, wow.
And he says, that's what I want Superman's funeral to look like. If that gives you any idea of where this guy's head was at. But the funny thing was, at the end,
frightening thing is that's what it should look like.
Right.
But it's, like, too soon.
Right, exactly. But at the end, you get these interviews with people after the movie's been, you know, they're talking about it. And John Peters was more broken up than anyone. You know, he wanted this movie more than anyone. Like, this was his baby. He had sunk 3 years of his time, all this money into this, you know, to make this movie that he thought was going to be amazing, and it wouldn't. And he was really destroyed by it. But to hear the story leading up to that point, like, you know, this crazy man producer comes up to this point where he really was so invested that this is just who he is, and then this is what he wants. But there's a B-line that I'm not going to spoil. There's a C-line story throughout it that's my favorite part, which is they made a mock-up of the Brainiac skull ship. And it's gorgeous. Look it up. Search for it online. It's amazing. It disappears during the falling apart of the movie. they find it in the documentary, which was the big revelation for me, is where did the skull ship go? They find the skull ship in the documentary. And that reveal is pretty amazing. So this movie, I can't suggest it enough. It's amazing. It answers a lot of unanswered questions that have – it's been a piece of comic book mythology for a very long time. What happened? What's with these images of Nick Cage in this weird-looking suit? What's with this blue suit? You know, Kevin Smith's been telling these stories, but nobody knows really what's happened. Now you get to know the whole story, and it's well worth every minute of that hour and a half. I could talk the rest of this podcast about this, but the hour and a half is well worth your time. So that was my initial offering tonight. Was that?
That's pretty impressive offering, and you know, I'm following with something in a much more pedestrian vein, actually.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Because it's hard to follow that. Among other things, but I was looking around just to see. I wanted to, you know, have perhaps a bit of a palate cleanser from.
Oh
Crumb,
yeah, well yeah.
That's a lot to take in, and you know, I wanted something a little bit more mainstream.
Sure.
And I discovered, I'm trying to remember now, it was Comics, it was C-O-M-I-X.
Okay.
And it was like Beyond, let me see here. I should know this by now, but yes, it's Comics Beyond the Comic Book Page is the name of the of the documentary itself. And the thing about it is it looked like it might have some potential. And in fact, as I was doing some research, apparently it was, it's one of the more modern crowdsource type of things. I actually found the Kickstarter, Help Me Fund Comics Beyond the Comic Book Page.
Really? Okay.
Documentary. In fact, I'm interest is even more piqued in talking about it. But I noticed that, Stan Lee, Frank Miller, John Romita Jr. It had some people with some pedigree,
sure,
to be on this film. So I decided to, give it a chance, and it's a decent enough documentary. It's it subscribes or gives in a little bit too much to being overproduced, because it tries to. It looks like the type of thing that you could almost sell to the networks. Only in a more abbreviated form.
Sure.
Because there's a lot of, freeze frame, fudge it into a comic book looking art, and then go through a bunch of actual comic panels and get over to the next part of the thing. Almost like you're going to commercial break or the end of the commercial break on the Wild Wild West or something. And just to kind of bring it around to the producer of Superman Lives, there's a lot of just sort of that, and at the points where they go wander around at both San Diego Comic-Con and one other big convention, I think it may have been one of the Wizard World. It was a Wizard World, but I'm not sure which one. I didn't pay it enough mind to notice, and they didn't like go out of their way other than Comic-Con to mention where they were. But when they go out and mix with the fans, it seems like the visuals, and they're trying to pinpoint fans in costume, are just dance away from comics too often. They sort of didn't dance with the one that brung them.
Right, sure.
I guess they couldn't find enough fascinating costume, comic book costumes to focus on. So, you're talking to various movie and television iconic type characters that have nothing to do with comics. The Lara Croft chick, that's all well and good, but, remember your source material, documentarians. Don't go get distracted by these other things. The couple of times they show this guy who was calling himself Jedi Elvis, and apart from wearing a necklace that had the rebel symbol on it, I couldn't see anything of the costume. It was indistinguishable from Elvis, as near as I could tell. I mean, they didn't do any long shots to see if he maybe had some, but it didn't look like he had, a sequined Jedi robe. It was just an Elvis cat suit. And all I'm thinking of is you're trying to ride the coattails of Ken Tarleton, the Elvis trooper, who took the idea of the stormtrooper costume and meshed it with Elvis sensibilities, including the kind of little mini cape thing and his Elvis impersonator look, and the two mesh because he added elements of Elvis to the costume. This was just sort of a guy walking around calling himself Jedi Elvis. But that, see, I'm getting like the documentary. I'm getting off track. Where its strengths are that it's fairly well structured. It tries to cover a lot of ground from comic book creators, comic book creation, tips from the pros, breaking in, the fans, the artists, the writers, the colorists, for God's sake. They're throwing colorists a bone.
That's fantastic.
And, you know, they tackle the age-old issue about tracers, I mean, inkers. So it's got a lot of stuff, and they talk to a lot of people, including, of course, Stan Lee himself, who he adds so much because there are a lot of stories I'd heard that he tells on this one, but they were off, you know, they were picked up over many other different documentaries, interviews, what have you.
Sure.
So it is informative. It's a little bit, like I say, kind of overdone at some points, but for the most part, some fascinating stuff is you get a lot of coverage of Frank Miller and Neil Adams. You get John Romita Jr. talking about his influences and telling some little tales about, you know, some of his own experiences. You get some of the Image partners speaking on the topic of, you know, how Image came about. Some really fascinating stuff with Neil Adams having failed to discover Frank Miller.
Oh, really?
Just flatly, blatantly failing miserably. And Frank Miller's own perseverance that basically landed him his first work. And Neil Adams having to realize that he's actually a good artist.
He's like, okay, all right, I'll give him that.
But they talk to a lot of people. Sometimes, you know, the choices seem a little bit odd. But, you know, I guess in the process of making a documentary, you meet interesting people that perhaps aren't as interesting when they're interviewed.
Of course.
And I'm going to give them that conceit. you know, they get a chance to at least speak with a lot of people like Doug Jones, who's just absolutely wonderful if you ever get to meet him at a convention.
Fantastic.
And he has a wonderful appreciation for the fact that the fans are amongst the people. And I didn't realize he was a clown in the Red Triangle Circus.
Really?
I had no clue, and I've met the man, and I guess I was too self-absorbed to notice all of the picture offerings he had at all confident. But, you know, they talked to the founder of Dark Horse, who is an interesting bird in his own right.
Sure.
I've seen him interviewed before. But, you know, Stan Lee, for example, brings a lot of insights into, you know, he tells a story. I probably parroted this as best I could in my fake Stan Lee voice about the creation of Spider-Man.
Oh, okay.
And about how he pitches Spider-Man, and it's sort of like, well, you know, nobody wants to read about spiders. They're scary, and nobody wants a teenager. They're sidekicks and all this stuff, and the reason that what was interesting is I'd never heard the reason that Spider-Man got its start in Amazing Fantasy, because that was the last issue
right.
of Amazing Fantasy, and nobody gave a damn
right.
what they put in it. And then the numbers go through the roof. And of course, there's the wonderful Stan Lee story about, you know, remember that Spider-Man character we both loved so much? Which, you know, you have to wonder if the guy was trying to be tongue-in-cheek or he genuinely was just an ass and just superimposed himself onto something he hated or what have you.
I might have some information about that later.
Yeah, there's some little stories about, but also the knowing that you're going to be talking about Steve Ditko, what was interesting is I didn't know that Jack Kirby originally drew Spider-Man.
Right, sure.
And his style, which was ideal for so many things, did not capture what Stan Lee was looking for. And he's like, so I called Steve. And he said, you know, Frank didn't care. He had plenty of work. Probably drawing
Actually,
Monsters on the Prowl.
Not to step on your toes too much and not to jump ahead, he called Jerry Robinson. And Jerry Robinson said, I got a guy. Call Steve. That's what actually happened. Yeah, Batman luminary Jerry Robinson was Steve Ditko's mentor and said, I got a guy. You might want to call him. His name's Steve Ditko. You guys have met. Why don't you give him a call and see if he'll do it? And that's how that Spider-Man team-up actually happened. Yeah. We got all kinds of knowledge today.
Bill Finger had nothing to do with this one, did he?
No. Bill Finger just was being lashed by Bob Kane in a back room somewhere while smoking palm mall after palm mall.
Like, if you ever upstage me again, Finger. But, excuse me. But you also get, like, wonderful insights. Almost universally, any comic creator that's being interviewed, you spend part of the time they're being interviewed distracted by their collection in the background.
Oh, God, right.
You're just like Mark Wade, you're like looking, trying to spot, oh, he's got that little DC, whatever those were called, the precursors to the Mini-Mates. And he's got the whole Justice League with the table and the chairs that you... That was like the only place you could initially get Martian Manhunter.
Pocket Heroes, right.
Pocket Heroes, yes. He's got the whole damn set. And it's fun to especially those creators where they're able to sit down in their home or in their studio and really talk one-on-one with them. And just the humility expressed with a lot of them who are just amazed that they get to do what they do. So there's a lot of really good stuff there. It's entertaining, but it's from the standpoint of its production, I can only recommend it as just sort of a curious, fun little thing to watch. It's worth watching. It's not one of the better comic documentaries I've ever seen. Yeah. But there's a lot of neat little insights, and even the worst documentaries, if you can come away from them with some interesting insights, it's worth it. And I believe it's on Netflix or on Amazon. May have been on Amazon Prime that I saw it for, because I'm cheap and that was another part of its appeal. But I was also kind of curious because I've seen some really fun documentaries where they just talk to a mountain of creators.
Right. That's awesome. So you would definitely suggest it if you've got an extra hour and a half to blow.
I would recommend, but I would suggest it's worth your time to watch it. You know, it's one of those you can get up and walk away, make a sandwich, come back to it because it's streaming. But, you know, you don't get married to it. I can see, like, with Death of Superman Lives, I would have just... You know, I would just let my bladder suffer if I had to go to the bathroom for that one, from the sound of things.
We'll definitely
be wanting to see that one.
The funny thing is, you mentioned the collection in the background. Most of the interviews were done in this guy's house, and he has a magnificent collection behind him at all times, like around the entire area. And I was constantly doing that. I would have to rewind to hear what they said because I'm trying to pick out the maquette that's behind them, or they're in Kevin Smith's house and he has all of this brilliant, you know, paraphernalia. And I'm like, crap. Now I got to back it up and watch it again because I missed what he said because I was trying to puzzle piece together what was behind him. It was fantastic. So my last documentary that I watched, speaking of Spider-Man and speaking of Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, was a documentary called In Search of Steve Ditko. Now, the reason that this is a mystery is because Steve Ditko, by his nature, is a very reclusive guy. You don't see him a lot. He doesn't do convention appearances. He doesn't get out and talk to people. So he just – one day he walked into Marvel's offices, turned in his last story, and left, and no one knew why. So why did that happen? That's what this is. Now, the host of this...
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, and the host... Trying
a
to figure
nice,
out...
A nice choice of jumping off point, as it were.
Yeah. You positioned that very well, sir. The host of this is a guy named... is a guy named Jonathan Ross. Jonathan Ross did this as a part of a thing that I didn't know existed called the Comics Britannia series. The Comics Britannia series has a documentary on Heath Robinson, on Bruins, on Wooly, Tintin and I is one of the ones they did. They did one called Comic Strip Heroes. They did a thing on Tron, based on the Mobius type situation. So I went from a very American documentary to a very, very British documentary. Like the most British. There wasn't an English accent or an American accent to be seen for the, about an American comic artist. That was the funny thing was like, you had, Mark Miller, you had Mark Millar, you had, Alan Moore all over this thing. I guess you did have Ralph. I always want to pronounce his name Ralph Macchio. You had Joe Quesada. You had. I mean, so there were some. Neil Gaiman was in it. But the story is the crux is what happened to Steve Ditko. But more importantly, is because he isn't in the public eye the way that Jack Kirby was or Stan Lee was or Finger and Kane were, he kind of has become this mystery of a man that you don't get a lot of interviews. So it's kind of piecing together the puzzle of who he was. Now, I will say that they do, because it wouldn't have been made into a documentary if they wouldn't have found him, and they did, but I'm not going to spoil what happens when they do, but the host of the thing, as well as Neil Gaiman, find him in New York. And come just short of trying to accost him. I'm not going to tell you what happens, but it was pretty awesome to see. But the real revelations in this were, you know, the man himself. I'm not going to get into the Spider-Man. We all know why Spider-Man's appealing, and we all know why sort of a more streamlined, neurotic art style works better for Spider-Man than the Jack Kirby bombastic New Gods type art style. You know, you're telling a more intimate story. It's more toned down and scaled down, which is why Ditko was perfect for that early run of Spider-Man. But he also had a bunch of good years left in him. Why did he just walk away? And there's a lot of speculation, and they talked to a lot of creators that were influenced by Ditko about what would have happened. And I think the biggest ones for me, first of all, and I made a note of this. We'll post my notes because they're insane. But
they always are.
One of the things I put on here was that for a recluse, Alan Moore loves to be on screen because he's just on screen more than anyone else ever in this thing. Like, just he loves Steve Ditko, and I figured out why. You figure out why later.
Okay.
You figure out later that Ditko created the question for Charlton Comics later to be used as one of the templates for Rorschach in Watchmen.
Yes, indeed.
But Ditko also created another character for Wits End Comics named Mr. A. Have you ever heard of Mr. A, Cole?
I cannot say I have.
Mr. A was based on what we now know, what has been revealed to me through this documentary and what is known to his compatriots, his confederates, as the fact that He was very staunchly, like, okay, so his favorite author was Ayn Rand. So very much, Mr. A was a comic book character who was a vigilante. Mr. A had his business card was a white business card that was half white and half black, because that's the way Mr. A saw the world. This was Ditko's achievemental character. This was the epitome of his work. His application of Randian objectivism into comics was this character Mr. A, which more than states that Mr. A was as much a template for Rorschach as the question. And the quote that I wrote down, I backed it up to get it right, was, oh yes, Rorschach, he's like Mr. A, except he's insane. But you get this, you start getting this story about a reclusive man being Steve Ditko. Never was interested in money. Didn't take any money from the Spider-Man movies. kind of lives in what does Alan Moore, or what does Alan Moore refer to it as? I'm looking back through my notes about the way that he lived. Reduced circumstances is what Alan Moore referred to it as, because he wouldn't
That's
take
a very
any
British money. Way of putting it.
Right? But, you know, he went on to
English.
Yeah, English. He went on to make, you know, he was talking about how after Spider-Man, he made the Question, but he also went into DC and made the Creeper, which Alan Moore says apparently the Creeper's only power was that he could laugh at will, and which I thought was really funny. And Hawk and Dove, which he said kind of worked on that objectivism dichotomy, where you had the yes. warbird, and then you had the dove that would always, you know, speak out against war, that he was a very conflicted man. But I think the most interesting thing about the entire documentary was you get this picture painted of this very moralistic high road guy, that one of the speculations as to why he left Superman is because of arguments over Stan Lee wanting there to be a protest in one of the comics. And Ditko not wanting any of the dirty hippies in his comic. that type of argument, right? You get that type of guy, and they say that political dissonance is one of the reasons that they think that Ditko left Spider-Man. To this day, nobody knows exactly why, except for Ditko and maybe Stan Lee. But there's all this speculation as to why that gets revealed. For instance, one of the really interesting kind of duality pieces is Ditko not only created Spider-Man for the Marvel Universe, he also created Doctor Strange.
Yes, indeed.
And Doctor Strange was viewed at the time as this parable for drug use and for hippie life and for open life.
Oh, wow, that must have killed him.
Well, and he said, and when I forget who it was, it might have been Ramada talked to him about it and said, you know, where do these things come from? You know, where do your ideas come from? And he was like, they just come from my imagination. And I think he was incensed at the fact that they thought that
that necessarily has to be an analog to something or
another cool thing was the you know, the Kool-Aid acid tests. The classic, and I forget the name of the author, but the beat kind of time when they were doing the Kool-Aid acid test, they would be given and read copies of Doctor Strange.
Indeed.
Which is really, really cool. I never knew that. That is amazing to me. And then they ran through a lot of stuff on the 70s TV show pilot, which I love. I just friggin' love it. But that's beside the point. Yeah. Neil Gaiman said that Steve Ditko was quote unquote magnificently uptight and probably left for political reasons. That they fought over dirty hippies and they also fought over the identity of the Green Goblin. There was a lot of plot fights, I guess, in Spider-Man, and they think that that might have been the reason that they left.
And, you know, I can see where that would happen. In fact, in the comics, Beyond the Comic Book Page, they talk about somehow, I forget which who they were talking to about the way artists and writers, you know, he says that oftentimes you'll have an artist and writer who are just like hand in glove, and others, it's just, you know, they almost never see each other. And they said that there are a couple of different ways that you can approach the writing of a comic, and that is to either you literally script it out like a movie script and you hand it over to the writer who just simply – or the artist who simply translates that into visuals, or you do it the Marvel way. And I thought, wow, it's still called the Marvel way. And the Marvel way is essentially that you plot the thing out, hand it over to the artist. The artist draws everything, and then you literally – the dialogues come later. And that's why so often the comics would seem – you know, you look at a lot of modern comics and the way they're scripted, you're like, wow, this is just – there's such synergy there. It's because writers started caring about the structure and the quality of how the story and the art meshed, instead of just, you know, writing the dialogue to fit the pictures.
Right.
And I can see where a lot of that would come up, because, you know, you have a half-written story given to an artist who interprets things, and then the dialogue is coming like, oh, that's not what I drew. I didn't draw him as a dirty hippie.
Right, exactly, yeah. Well, they were saying that they didn't want – one of the big fights was the Green Goblin. and they didn't want the Green Goblin. They didn't think Ditko didn't think that the Green Goblin should be Harry Osborn or Norman. I'm sorry, Norman Osborn, because they didn't want it to be in Ditko's mind. It shouldn't have been somebody that Peter knew. It shouldn't be somebody that was in Peter's life already. And in Stan's mind, because Stan is the P.T. Barnum of comics.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that was Ditko was trying to tell a really thought out story. And Stan Lee was trying to sell comics, which is very much in his right to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Stan wants the sensationalism that he's a, newspaper mogul in a sense.
Right. Exactly. So that was, I think, the big fight. And I'm going to end it with this. There was an interview at the end with – I'm not going to spoil it. I'm not going to tell you anything about it with Stan Lee, which is worth the entire – it's only an hour long, which is worth the hour to watch. That and goddamn Alan Moore at the end of the damn thing looks into the camera when he's talking about Mr. A, and he's like – yeah, I can't do that. I'm not going to try the accent, the Alan Moore accent. But he's like, yeah, my band wrote a song about Mr. A. And John's like...
of course they did.
And John looks at him, he's like, wait, what? And Alan Moore looks dead into the camera, he's like, you want to hear a verse? And before anything else, starts singing his song about Mr. A into the camera. And I write in my notes, and just circle it, the biggest thing... This is worth watching, if only for Alan Moore.
I was reading that this morning, as a matter of fact.
Alan Moore has a goddamn song about Steve Ditko, is what I wrote. But yes, this is brilliant. And, you know, you and I were talking before the show that we've...
Yeah, that's like naming your band Krabby Appleton, because the character appeared on a cartoon. And...
But he proceeds to sing this song about Mr. A. But we were talking before the show tonight that we've done a disservice in not talking more about Steve Ditko.
Yes, indeed. And one thing, the revelation here, and it'll probably be repeated when we finally do a show about Steve Ditko, is in my youth, in my naive and early... my entree into comics, and as my tastes began to develop in comics, I declared Steve Ditko the worst artist in comics.
Whew, that's rough.
That is terrible. And this, you know, at the time, I think I'd encountered things like, what was the DC one with the guy that projected the monster out from himself? And
not Dial H for...
No, it was... oh, now I shouldn't have even invoked it because I can't remember the damn character's name. But Ditko was actually producing some work well into the 80s, I think.
Yeah, he was.
And possibly even into the 90s. And I just thought, you know, this is crap. I mean, in all fairness, I will point out in my defense that Rob Liefeld had yet to make...
You're the worst.
But I'm just going to ensure that we will never, either we'll never get Rob Liefeld on here, or we'll get him on here as kind of a grudge thing.
Well, we'll get him on here to apologize for things he's never heard of
before. I will go to record, I will apologize for everything I ever said about him if he'll come on the show.
Exactly. But
we're going to vet the hell out of that. No pretending to be him. No, oh yeah, I love Lee Jeans. No, we're not falling for that again.
No, but we've done creator spotlights on – well, first of all, we did a 5-issue creator spotlight on Alan Moore.
I didn't base Deadpool on Deathstroke. What? No, sorry.
No, we did – we've done Stan – we've done Jack. We've done Frank. We've done – you know, we've done –
we've done John Byrne. We have slated to do any number of other
– yeah.
And there's so many creators that I'm afraid we're going to be plotting well into – 2019 at the rate I'm going, because I would like to insert more creator spotlights,
but it's
into the mix. And I'm gonna, why don't we do this? I've been putting together the back issue bins to make it easy for our listeners to go back and find every single issue.
Right.
It will be, when this is released, we're going to put out 4 long boxes that comprise the back issue bins with 50 plus issues per bin. And as I was putting it together, it had 1 through 50, plus annual number 1, 51 to 100, plus annual number 2. I put in 50, 101 to 150, plus annual number three before I realized we've not done an annual number three. We have not done an annual number four. We have not had an annual in some time. So I'm going to announce right here, right now, Hey Kids Comics annual-ish number three. And we'll come up with some smart-ass title that invokes Steve Ditko.
There you go. Well, I mean, the man co-defined Spider-Man, if not created, at least defined the character in its...
Okay, with apologies to Walt Kelly and to yourself for interrupting you, I go Ditko.
But, you know, the man...
Put that in my show note.
There, this is my note. But he, you know, Doctor Strange, we talked about the Question, the Creeper, you know, the man is seminal and loved and deserves recognition more so than I think he's getting across the board. So I think that we need to rectify that situation. Do you have any final thoughts on comic book documentaries as a whole?
I think it is an important genre of documentarianism. Is that
it is now.
Yeah. But I think as documentaries go, I think it's one of those things where we should all be fascinated and thrilled that these things exist. You know, that there are documentaries,
right,
on comic books, on comic creators, on comic genres, on comic history. There's so much information out there to be found, and in the documentarian kind of format, there's so much to be offered. And so I can't say enough. Just go out there and discover, because I was overwhelmed by how many documentaries there were out there in actuality. And Shade the Changing Man, by the way.
Oh, there he is. Okay. He's seen a resurgence recently, by the way.
Oh.
Yeah. That's, you know, I couldn't have said it better myself, Cole. That's absolutely true. If you love comics, watch a lot of these documentaries. They're very cool. You learn things about the comics that you never knew, about creators that you never knew. A lot of mysteries are revealed. You get to hear Alan Moore sing songs.
I'm looking forward to taking that one in as well. There were several I wanted. It was hard to, you know, just settle on a couple. But I wanted to pick something that unexpected. I didn't want to go all in with all the most outrageous hard target subjects, because there are so many really good documentaries out there that do paint in those broad brushstrokes.
Right. And I do want to thank a couple of people. I want to thank 85Barrowman_Ons. I want to thank Gintu and Terry Cahill on Reddit for helping us with this show tonight. It is greatly appreciated. Cole, why don't you plug us up? We'll get out of here. We've gone long once again. I've been doing a really bad job of wrangling, but I really like talking about these things. So
we've had a couple of episodes that just it's hard to stop. It's
there's so much fun.
It's hard to find a place where we can just say, okay, we've said our piece. So having said our piece, you can check out these and other pieces at Jedi Cole Universe at JediCole.com. As I said, probably within a couple of weeks, we'll be dropping the long box or the back issue bins out there. One of the reasons it's taking a while is because I'm having to systematically go back and add what I call cover art to 200 episodes plus of the show, because I'm posting the embed tags,
right,
in stacks of 50 plus, and I wanted something other than the same logo over and over and over, and I want something to give you at least an idea of what we're talking about on each. And it visually, it's looking beautiful. I'm having to go back and listen to a couple of episodes, remember what the hell we talked about, because I wanted to make it at least look like I knew what I was doing when I came up with the flavor art. But, you know, do check that out on Jedi Cole Universe, JediCole.com. We are now officially part of the Cinelinks family. We will start very soon putting content on the Cinelinks site. I'm working on that. God bless him. Jordan at Cinelinks has been very patient with my slow-moving and technologically challenged nature. And but we are now powered by Cinelinx. So,
that's amazing.
Be sure to check out Cinelinx.com. We'll soon be seeing more from us there, and I'm going to start putting together some other feature stuff that doesn't appear on my website. It's part of theirs. And you can write to us at jcumail@yahoo.com. I'm going to start, I realize, due to a complete and abject total lack of any email, and the fact that with the Ranker Pit, Eddie seems to get all of our mail.
Right.
Because he's not using mail. He's using the Reddits and the other things. So
sure.
I'm going to be looking into joining the ranks of those who utilize modern means of communication. So soon I'll have some more things to mention. Check out the Ranker Pit, the Ranker Pit Live, rather, YouTube channel.
There you go.
And the Jedi Cole YouTube channel has been grossly underutilized, and I keep promising content, and I haven't quite made that happen. But we're working on that, including some comicsumentaries, perhaps.
There you go. So
and I do tweet. I'm getting more active at tweeting on the Twitter, so you can also look for us at the Jedi Cole U for our Twitter account.
I've been tweeting as well from the Hey Kids Comics Twitter account. So that's been a little more
damn
active.
I can subscribe to that thing.
I know, right? It's there's some stuff on there. Not a lot, but there's some stuff on there. So yes, everybody, thank you. Buy, enjoy, and collect your comics. Watch your comic documentaries. They're amazing. And and until we get
comic commentary. That was harder than I thought it was.
It had to be hard. So until we can get LaFeld on the show, we're going to bid you adieu. Say goodnight, Cole.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Cole, how's that set up for that Lee Jeans commercial coming?
Well, I'm going to claim that I created every comic character ever.
Oh, nice. You're just going to repaint, like, some wings on the side of their head?
Pretty much, and then I'm just going to do a lot of jaunty little, you know, camera angles and quick cuts. Thank you.